This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, this is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Kelly Anissa. Divorce cases among Muslim couples in Malaysia are carried out in a separate court, and over the years there have been statements made about the backlog and how the process tends to take a heavier toll on women. So joining me today is Nizam Bashir. He is a Sharia lawyer, and we explore this further and try to understand why, in some instances, a case can even stretch out for years before reaching a conclusion. Welcome to the show, Nizam.
Hi.
So in 2013, it was reported that Muslim couples are getting divorced at a rate nearly double that of their non-Muslim counterparts, giving rise to alarm among the authorities. What are the stats like now?
Okay, in 2017, the number of Muslim divorces was 39,709. And non-Muslim divorces was 10,256. So I suppose if you were to look at it in terms of a ratio, the divorce ratio between Muslim and non-Muslims are approximately 4-1.
What were the leading causes behind the high rates of divorce cases among Muslim couples?
Unfortunately, when I looked at the statistics on this, they didn't quite identify the reasons why there's this high rate of divorce among Muslim couples. But I've looked at some other studies, and the reasons can vary depending on the length of the marriage. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the break, for example, in a young or new marriage, the reasons can be things, trivial reasons like washing clothes at night. Mm. Husband doesn't like the wife eating in the car. Yeah. So whereas for marriages which have lasted for a number of years, it can end up in divorce due to things like misunderstanding between couples. Maybe even in-laws getting involved in the marriage, and of course domestic violence is also another one of those reasons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is for Muslim marriages, right?
Muslim marriages, but I suppose you can also apply that also to even non-Muslim marriages.
Mm. And how would a Muslim file for divorce in Malaysia? So I understand there's the talak and the fasak. So maybe you could elaborate on that for us.
Yeah, there are various types of divorces that a Muslim couple can seek. Yeah, so for example, let's take a look at talak. Now, talak is a divorce which is obtained pursuant to an order of court, and it takes place either where the husband or the wife, husband and wife agrees to divorce by consent, or where the husband decides to divorce the wife by pronouncing talak. Okay. Then you also have fasak, which is basically a dissolution of the marriage, and it's provided for by Section 52 of the Islamic Family Law Federal Territories Act. There are a number of grounds where one can seek a divorce by way of fasak, and this can include things like when the wife doesn't know the whereabouts of the husband has failed to provide maintenance for a period of 3 months, imprisonment, impotence, insanity, husband treats the wife with cruelty, etc. So it's quite wide in terms of the grounds by which you can move the court for fasak. Yeah? Then there's also lian, which is a type of divorce that occurs where the husband accuses the wife of committing adultery or denies that the child that is being carried by the wife is his child. There's also hulu. This is a form of divorce where the wife seeks divorce on the basis that she's prepared to pay a certain amount or provide a certain item to the husband in exchange for a divorce. And there's also ta'liq, which is a form of divorce when there's a breach of conditions stipulated after nikah or solemnization of marriage is carried out between a couple. Yeah, so there are a number of ways where a Muslim couple can move the court for divorce.
And can this be initiated by both men and women? Or, for example, talak, is that only initiated by the husband?
Talak, by and large, it is something that is initiated by the husband. Okay. But let's say that, the husband and wife agrees to the divorce. Yeah. So there's consent. In those circumstances, it can be initiated even by the other party.
Can you walk us through the process of a divorce proceeding here, and how does it differ from a civil court divorce case?
Well, the primary difference between a divorce in a Sharia courts and a divorce in a civil court is that the present arrangement is divorce in the Sharia courts can take place by way of a number of separate proceedings. Yeah. So in other words, you move the court for divorce, and you then perhaps can file, for example, a custody of children application. You can then also file a maintenance application. And in some circumstances, you may have to wait for the conclusion of the divorce proceedings first before you can initiate some related proceedings. For example, when you are seeking or trying to make a claim for Harta Sabancarian, which is a claim for matrimonial property, you have to wait till you conclude your divorce proceedings. Then you can move the court for a claim for Harta Sabancarian. The only exception to what I've just said about this Harta Sabancarian proceeding being initiated after divorce is when it is made when there's an application for polygamy. Then there's no divorce as such, of course, but the wife may want to make an application so that it's clear what is her entitlement to the property of the family. Yeah. Mm. So whereas in a civil court, when divorce proceedings are instituted, it is in effect instituted in one go. Yeah. So you make the claim for divorce, you make the claim for custody, you make the claim for matrimonial property, all essentially in one proceeding. So it is you don't take it almost by installments.
Right.
Right. So that's the primary difference.
And is that why there is such, I've read so many statements online about the backlog in cases, in Sharia cases. So is that one of the reasons why?
Well, the strange thing is this. I think when they mooted the idea of splitting proceedings up in that way, the idea really was for speed. Mm-hmm. Okay. So the authorities were thinking that if they allowed, for example, divorce to be dealt with first, that should expedite the conclusion of the divorce proceedings between the parties, as opposed to being sort of bogged down by your custody application, your Harta Sabancarian application. Yeah, but it's not worked out, I think, in that way. Certainly, if you look at comments being made by single mothers in particular, they say that, look, there's been a lot of delay. And I think certainly that delay can be attributed to the fact that proceedings have been split in that way.
And what are the other factors behind this delay in all these divorce cases?
I think the other issues that can creep in or that adds to this delay happening in the Sharia courts is this. There's this efforts to try and serve proceedings on the parties. And, because I think the courts are also trying to be cautious about, proceeding in the absence of parties, I suppose they tend to sort of, sometimes perhaps bend over backwards to ensure that parties are present, although the rules do allow for proceedings to proceed without all parties being present. Mm. Yeah. And sometimes it's also because, there's adjournments being requested. So maybe it's a question of being firm about things like that, yeah, so that proceedings can go ahead without too much delay and be the subject of complaint of either whichever party that's before the Sharia courts.
And what are the other causes behind the backlog? Years ago, in 2011, I think, this was attributed to the lack of Sharia judges. Is this still the case today?
The number of Sharia judges, I think, really isn't the main issue. Yeah, I mean, in terms of my personal observation of why perhaps there's delay, as I said, I think it is perhaps attributable to this split of proceedings. Yeah, in fact, what has happened, the authorities have also noted that could be a problem. In roughly April 2018, they started mooting the creation of this specialized court to deal with all these disparate matters in one court. So you have got a specialized court which deals with divorce, custody, and Harta Sabancarian. Mm-hmm. Now, but it's still a relatively new sort of creation. So we'll have to wait and see, whether that's going to achieve the goal of eradicating these delays. Yeah.
And how long does the average divorce proceeding take for Muslim couples?
There's actually a KPI on cases that is being heard in the Sharia court. So, for example, for divorce matters, generally it's about 9 months. All right. Mm-hmm. So it's not as if that there are no timelines to be met. there are timelines.
Right.
Yeah, but I suppose the question then becomes, over and above the fact that there are timelines, are we or are the relevant authorities monitoring those timelines? Is it being met? Is it being observed? Yeah.
So if a proceeding were to carry on for a longer period, say a few years, what can be done about that? Is there a regulatory body that Muslim couples can go and speak to about these cases?
Sure. That's why when I spoke about the fact that, you know, timelines are one thing, but monitoring compliance with the timeline, I think, is more crucial. And if a matter takes too long, Muslim couples can, I think, make a complaint letter to either the chief judge of whichever Sharia court in the particular state, or even address their complaint letter to the Jabatan Kehakiman Syariah Malaysia, JKSM. Yeah. And I think these sort of complaints, if parties certainly are subjected to anything beyond the 6 to 9 months time frame, they ought to highlight that to the chief judge, to the JKSM, and maybe even bring it up in the papers, for example. Because sometimes when, I suppose, authorities feel that there are no complaints, they think that the system is working, you know, they may think that the relevant judicial personnel is doing their job, but when, you know, the reality of it may be something quite different altogether.
And Islamic law varies by state, is that correct? How does this affect the divorce cases? In what way do they differ by state?
Okay, constitutionally speaking, Islamic law is a matter for each state. So if a state opts to enact Islamic family law differently on a matter, naturally it can impact on the rights that parties have. Now, having said that, rather interestingly, states have actually have opted to sort of adopt a uniform sort of Islamic family law. So the legislation on this in this regard is actually quite similar, if not identical. So strictly speaking, divorce laws in Malaysia, you know, because there's no difference, there's no impact on I suppose the divorce cases that comes before the Sharia courts. But the thing is, practices can vary across the states. So you have laws which are uniform, but practices can still vary. So for example, in the Klang Valley, for example, in Klang or in Selangor, hakam, which is a way one deals with divorce matters, hakam is widely used, okay? But in for example, Melaka or even Terengganu, it's not used as a mode of dealing with divorce matters. Mm-hmm.
And what is a hakam?
Hakam is a mode of dealing with divorce matters, whereby it operates, you know, sort of in a way that it's conciliatory between the parties, where the panel is made up by close family members. Okay, and the idea, I suppose, is to avoid divorce.
Right.
All right. So the representatives of the family will try and work towards a sort of an amicable resolution of the issues between the parties. That is the initial stages, of course. But if at some point, you know, those family members take the position that, you know, the matter cannot be resolved, then it moves to the second stage where I suppose parties can be sort of guided towards a divorce.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And this hakam can pronounce divorce on behalf of the husband if the husband does not want to appear before court, right?
It depends. In the initial stages, as I said, the hakam is constituted by close family members, okay? And if the husband elects to appoint that or endow that close family member with the power to pronounce divorce, yes, the hakam can pronounce divorce on behalf of the husband. Now, let's assume that the husband refuses to grant that power to that close family member. That's when you come to the second stage, where the hakam is made up of parties appointed by the court. Okay, and the court can grant the power of pronouncing the divorce, irrespective of the wishes of the husband. Okay, so hakam, the powers can be quite wide, and where Selangor and KL are concerned, it's becoming quite popular as a mode of dealing with, you know, issues between husband and wife.
We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be looking at the challenges that Muslim women face in divorce cases and the custody rights. I am speaking to Nizam Bashir, a Sharia lawyer, and we're talking about divorce cases involving Muslim couples in Malaysia. You're listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Kelly Anissa. Joining me on the show today is Nizam Bashir, a Sharia lawyer, and we're talking about divorce cases involving Muslim couples in Malaysia. Is there any truth that when a divorce application is made by a woman, it tends to be lengthier?
I've never heard of that. I would be quite surprised if that was the case. And certainly if there were any complaints in that regard, I would hope that the authorities look into it quite seriously, because I think that would be extremely inappropriate.
I ask because there was an article online, I think published 3 years ago, where some Muslim women felt allegedly stonewalled in divorce cases.
Well, I don't know what happened in whichever specific case that perhaps was set out in whichever newspaper. But I think as a matter of principle, it doesn't matter, you know, whether it is the husband or the wife that files whichever proceeding. I think the standards have to be the same. The length of time has got to be the same. The principles of law has got to be the same. It shouldn't matter whether it is the husband or the wife that files whichever proceeding.
And how would the process differ for couples where if one of them were, say, in a non-Muslim marriage, if one of them were to convert to Islam, how would a case like that be handled? Or, say, in a Muslim couple, if one of them were to convert out of the religion, how would cases like those be handled? Would they still be under the provision of Islamic law?
Well, if, let's say, one couple has converted out, strictly speaking, of course, there is a problem with the proceedings continuing in the Sharia court because the other couple is no longer subject to the Sharia court's jurisdiction, yeah? But there may be some related issues which needs to be dealt with nevertheless in the Sharia court. For example, in terms of getting an order to affirm the status of the marriage, I mean, the remaining spouse is still a Muslim. He or she may still be required to get an order merely to ensure there is some certainty as to her status for future marriages.
And so this is the same, say, if a non-Muslim couple, so if one of them were to convert during the course of the marriage, what would a divorce case like that look like? Would it still be carried out in civil court first because, you know, they had gotten married while both of them were not Muslim, for example?
Yeah, there used to be, I suppose, some uncertainty about that, whether the civil courts could deal with that issue. But I think with the recent amendments to the Law Reform Marriage Divorce Act, that has changed somewhat. That issue has been addressed. The civil courts can deal with the marriage because the marriage was contracted under civil laws. Okay? So that clarity is something that I think we can thank the government for.
And there was this article in The Star for one instance where the writer who wanted to divorce her, her husband, who she said was alcoholic at the time, who was also sexually abusive towards her, was told by the court that drinking is no reason for divorce. So can a judge reject a divorce on such grounds? Does that ever happen?
Let's say that you have one party who is a teetotaler, who doesn't drink, okay? And the other party does. So the party that is a teetotaler can initiate a dissolution of the marriage. Let's say that this is the wife in particular, yeah? Okay? So the wife can initiate a dissolution of the marriage on the grounds that the husband is not living according to the tenets of Islam. Section 52 sub 1 L of the Islamic Family Law Act 1984 envisages such a situation where husband does not live according to the tenets of Islam. So you can move the court easily for divorce on those grounds. In any event, we can also look at Section 47 and 48 of the Islamic Family Law Act, where close family members appointed to a hakam can resolve the issue of the husband drinking by taking that fact into account and make an order of a dissolution of the marriage. So that's why I said earlier, hakam is actually quite broad. You can deal with a range of scenarios, and this is one of those things that you can deal with. So I suppose when you're talking about the article in the Star, it may have been, it may have happened at a time where hakam was not popular as a procedure.
Yeah.
So that could have been why.
Is there enough representation of female judges in the Sharia legal system?
I think things are changing.
Mm-hmm.
Although, I think it's important to first take note of the fact that, you know, female judges were only appointed to Sharia courts, only as far back as 2010. So we're not even, you know, a 10 years from that particular time frame. Yeah. So, but nevertheless, since 2010, the number of female Sharia court judges, I think they are growing,
mm-hmm.
particularly in the Sharia lower courts. So I think that's a good thing because I think the perspective that they have to offer can be quite different and quite valuable when they are looking at issues relating to family law, in particular the plight of single mothers as they're trying to wade through all the issues that they have to, you know, whether it is custody, whether it is Hartus Ben Sharian, anything of that sort.
And late last year, BBC named Nini Shushaida Shamsuddin as one of Malaysia's first two female Sharia High Court judges on its list of 100 Inspiring Women of 2018. And this was a milestone, right? But why do you think there is so little female representation in the Sharia courtroom? As, besides the fact that this has only recently come into effect?
I think that there is a move towards encouraging or ensuring that there are more female judges, yeah? But I wouldn't go so far as to say that there is any barriers to female judges being appointed. Whether this is, something, and whether that barrier is something that is set in place by the powers that be, I prefer to think that it's not intentionally there. So if it is there in terms of the numbers or the lack of numbers that we see of female judges in the Sharia court, I think it's more unintentional rather than anything else. I mean, certainly if you look at some of the comments that have been coming out from the authorities whenever appointments are being made, specifically where female judges are concerned, I think they have always welcome female judges. Yeah. So, of course, we hope that the numbers do grow in a manner that's more reflective about, I think, the number of litigants that do come to the Sharia courts, just to ensure that, you know, we gain that valuable perspective that, female judges can offer.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and during the period that it takes for the spouses to be legally divorced, what happens to the children?
Well, prior to a custody order being made, the child will be with whichever parent who has care for the child. But of course, after a custody order is made, custody will generally be given to the mother if the child is below 7, mm-hmm. if it's a boy, and if it's a girl, below the age of 9 years old. So, you know, effectively there's a presumption mm-hmm. custody is dealt with in that way.
Okay, so below the age of 7 for boys and 9 for girls, it goes to the mother.
That's right.
Okay. Why is that age a factor in whether or not the mother or father gets the custody?
Well, I think, essentially when the child is of that age, the law presumes that it is in the best interest of the child to be with the mother, okay? And of course, one can argue whether, in this day and age, whether it's appropriate to have such presumptions. But I think that's still fairly true. The child is would need, I think, the attention that perhaps a mother would be best placed to give. But, I think in cases where both father and mother are working, it does beg the question somewhat.
So earlier when we spoke about how some women feel that the process feels more tedious or longer for them, you said that you've not heard of such instances. So they don't face these challenges, specifically like the length of the divorce proceedings or the financial burden of like the divorce fees?
I would prefer to look at those issues as not being subjected to, as not arising due to gender. Okay? I think if those issues are present, it is present irrespective of the gender of the parties. But certainly if it is attributable very clearly to let's say, the fact that they are women,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that's certainly disconcerting if that's the case. But the thing is that beyond not hearing about these issues stemming purely from the gender of the parties, I've not read anything along those lines as well. Issues or complaints about delays in the court system, to me, it transcends even Sharia courts. You have similar complaints even happening in the civil courts. So I'm more inclined to think that the issues are there because there's a problem with the courts itself, rather than it being attributable to gender.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I'm coming from when I said I've not heard about these issues being faced purely by women.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking at that more from a gender perspective.
Okay. And do you think there are any loopholes in the Islamic family law that need to be addressed? Are there any amendments in the making?
Yeah. Well, I think family law is quite a unique area of the law where there has to be this very careful balance between speed and trying to address the complaints of the parties in the family court system, yeah? Because on the one hand, when parties are coming to the courts to look for a resolution of a matter, chances are they're coming there sometimes because they're emotionally upset about certain things,
mm-hmm.
okay? So sometimes people, run to the family courts because they're upset, angry about something. So some amount of cooling off period is sensible, to ensure that the marriage, if it can be preserved, it's allowed to be preserved. Then you've also got, on the flip side, I suppose, the fact that parties have made up their mind. They want to, sort of move on from the marriage. They want to draw a line. And in those instances, the courts have got to be very clear that they need to be able to deliver what litigants want, which is a quick resolution of the issues that they're facing. So, for example, if you have divorce cases stretching out for 5 years, etc., that certainly is not justice. That is something that I think the authorities have got to look into and try and remedy as best as they can. Yeah, divorce being one issue, custody, I think, is the other issue. Maintenance. Maintenance of children, I think that's the big bugbear forget about just even Sharia courts, even civil courts. But a lot of the complaints I find that, Muslim women raise, it's in relation to the delays that they face in terms of the divorce and also maintenance of children.
So about maintenance, who are both parents supposed to give an equal amount of financial support to both to their children?
By and large, the father is supposed to be the one responsible for the maintenance of the child. But of course, it's not problematic if the wife wants to contribute towards that as well. Yeah. Of course, if we follow the Singapore model in this, I think, issues or complaints about this will quickly end, in the sense that in Singapore, when there's an issue with maintenance, the recalcitrant parent will be subjected to imprisonment if he doesn't pay up.
In Singapore.
Yeah, in Singapore.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I've talked about this in the past. I know it's a bit radical,
mm-hmm.
but I think what is more important is we put the interests of children first and foremost. And if we do that, I think, that certainly is the way forward.
If a parent, or as you said, the father, who usually pays for the man, if they, in Malaysia, if they refuse to pay, what can the wife do? What cause of action can she take?
Well, she can, of course, pursue suitable orders in the Sharia courts. For example, even contempt proceedings, mm-hmm. if the order is there, and the father is refusing to, you know, shoulder his end of the bargain, they can move the court for those kind of proceedings. They can even execute against, for example, ensuring that there are pay deductions. Yeah, but you see, the problem is when you are trying to pursue new proceedings, there is always an expense. There's always an expense. So mm-hmm. as it is, single mothers, they're trying to juggle the finances of the household, mm-hmm. the upbringing of the children. Yeah. So I'm just thinking that we should be looking at something that's a little bit easier, less expensive, where, for example, the single mother fills up a form, complains about the fact that there's a maintenance order, husband or father is not doing what he's supposed to be doing, and then, you know, everything moves on its own. Yeah, things mm-hmm. I think should be simple for them.
And what kind of legal reforms do you want to see in the Islamic legal system here?
Well, one of the more important areas where I think the Sharia courts can perhaps consider reform is they should consider adopting a mediation process, okay, which is not confined perhaps only to the issues presently before them. So, for example, when a party comes to court and they have filed a divorce proceeding, the mediation can extend not just, and it's not confined just to the divorce itself, because when couples have, for example, you know, made up their mind, look, I don't want to be in this marriage any longer, there are a number of matters, a number of issues that needs to be dealt with. Of course, divorce is just one part of it. Custody of the child, maintenance. So perhaps we can look at the Singapore model where this is concerned, where mediation in family law matters extends to all relevant issues. Beyond expanding, I think, the issues that a mediator can look at, I think the other important thing is mediators must be appropriately trained. Because sometimes one of the complaints I've heard is when a mediation is carried out, the mediator, during the suluh or conciliation process, mm-hmm. merely sits at the side and right. doesn't take part in the discussions between the respective spouses. So you're not facilitating the discussion in that sense, yeah? So if training is going to take time, maybe we ought to consider, you know, sort of bringing in retired judges, lawyers, engage their services to assist families to, you know, deal with their respective issues. I mean, if you talk about the numbers that I talked about just now, I mean, you're talking about tens of thousands of couples, you know, who are undergoing a divorce.
Right.
Now, if you can assist those parties to resolve their issues in an expeditious fashion, mm-hmm. I think we are doing a service to those parties. And not just to the couples, yeah? Especially when children are involved. Maintenance issues affects their upbringing, yeah? And beyond mediation, maybe we want to also consider how to look at how Biro Bantuan Government grants aids, legal assistance aid to those who qualify. Mm-hmm. Because if one of the other common complaints that parties have when they approach Sharia courts is the fact, number one, they don't have sufficient money with them. They need to engage lawyers. So for those who are, you know, caught in the predicament of not being able to afford a lawyer, but then they've got to resolve their issues in court, we need to see how Biro Bantuan Guaman can step in and assist them in resolving their matters. So maybe even consider a bigger budget for the Biro Bantuan Guaman for Sharia matters. And beyond granting budgets, bigger budgets to the BBG, maybe even look at how we train Biro Bantuan Guaman officers, give them skill upgrades to deal with Sharia cases. Yeah. So just now I talked about the mediation process. For all you know, maybe even the BBG officers can sort of, wear two hats in that regard.
Yeah.
So things like that, I suppose. Those are things that I'm thinking of where we can improve upon to ensure that less complaints come from litigants who go to the Sharia courts.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for coming on the show today, Nizam. I've been speaking to Nizam Bashir, a Sharia lawyer, and we were talking about divorce cases involving Muslim couples in Malaysia. So if you've missed any part of this interview or any Live and Learn segment, you can download the podcast on the BFM app, available on Google Play, the App Store, and also on Spotify. You've been listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.